We've been walking through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, and it is great to have you here on this first, I think it's kind of the first hot weekend of the year. And so, in honor of that, no socks for me. I'm really excited about that. Hope I didn't gross you out just then. If I did, just don't look. It's all good. But my plan, like I said, was to kind of lump this chapter into the next two, because the next two chapters are the story of David and Bathsheba, which is one of the really famous stories about King David. Bathsheba, you know, being a... we'll get into it next week, all right? But as I got closer to this passage, I don't want to give it away, right? Be here next week, Memorial Day weekend, come anyway. This week, as I was getting closer to chapters 10 through 12, I just couldn't see how we were going to skip chapter 10. I just was reading it over and over, and I thought, there is something... I mean, I thought originally this was just another list of David's victories in battle, but there's something really profound here and a deep truth here. There were some scholars, some commentators who said, that there really is nothing theologically here that's really that important. It's just kind of lead into the next chapters. And I'm glad I found a few that kind of went where I went with it, because I just think that's wrong. I think there's so much here, and I'm really, I don't know if excited is the right word. I'm looking forward to talking about it. I'm a little bit... I hope that I do have the gentleness and also the boldness that it takes to kind of bring out some of what is here. Because these are some really convicting things for me. This chapter has been really convicting. Because we're going to be talking about the kind of thing that requires you. I mean, the big takeaway, all right, is open your heart to love from God and people. Open your heart to love from God and people. And when you're sitting and praying and thinking about, okay, that's what I'm going to talk about, you know, out in public in front of people, and it's going to go on the internet and stuff like that, that's a vulnerable place. And so I just want to invite you into that, because that's where we're going with these chapters. Well, so just a little background. If you haven't been here, since February, we've been going through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel in the Old Testament. And we've been looking at the life of King David. We've been seeing specifically God's grace in the life of King David. King David was, by most measures, the greatest king in Israel. He lived about 1,000 years before Jesus. He foreshadowed Christ's life in many amazing ways. And God, we saw God 2 weeks ago make an amazing promise to David about what he was going to do. And that comes true through Christ. And I've been saying that throughout these books that 1 and 2 Samuel are all about this choice that everybody has, this choice between, are we going to serve God or are we going to serve people? Are we going to live under God's glory and grace, or are we going to live for human glory and human grace? Which way will we go? What will we choose? And coming to 2 Samuel chapter 10, it first appears just to be another chapter about David's victories in war, but actually that same choice is going to be put before us. Are we going to serve God under his grace, or are we going to serve people and live by human power and human strength? And the area of life that this chapter speaks to most directly is the area, you know, it's the part of life that deals with how we interpret other people's actions. How we interpret other people's actions and words. To put it into a question, what motives do we ascribe to other people? What motives do we reflexively, instinctively impute or ascribe to other people? You know, there's like the cheap one, right? When somebody cuts us off in traffic, what motive are we? I use that one so much. Y'all are just going to either stop driving or stop coming here. I'll retire it. More seriously, when somebody says something unkind to us, or uncaring, or just thoughtless, what motive do we jump to that's behind that? Or even when somebody says something that is kind to us, a compliment, what motive do we ascribe to them? What do we read into their actions? Ask that question. Think about it for yourself if you're not already. When somebody says a kind word to you, maybe, what kind of heart do you assume that that's coming from? Here are some options, and I've seen these in my own heart. Maybe they're saying this kind thing because they're about to tell me something that I don't want to hear, right? And that colors how you receive the compliment. The other shoe's going to drop. When does the but come into the sentence, right? Or maybe they're saying this to get something from me.
They're buttering me up to get a favor. Or maybe this is just Southern kindness, and this is really something they actually don't like about me. Y'all know it's true, yeah. And then somewhere way down on the list, at least for me most of the time, is, no, they actually just want to make a compliment because they like this thing about me. What motive do we assume is coming from other people? Now, I'm going to put a word on this. Today, what we're talking about, what we're going to try to address, what this chapter is addressing, is cynicism. Cynicism. And I happen to be an expert, all right, in cynicism, but I am recovering. Cynicism, what is it? According to the dictionary, cynicism is an inclination to believe that people are motivated primarily by self-interest or skepticism. Cynicism, the way I'm using it today, is it is an inclination to believe that people are motivated purely by self-interest. Skepticism of other people. That's cynicism. Are you cynical? That's what we're going to be talking about. And the big idea that comes right out of this chapter and reverberates, I think, throughout all reality and reverberates in our culture is this. The cynical crowd is living under human strength. But if we live by God's grace, we'll be open to being loved. And then we'll give love too. The cynical crowd is living under human strength, but those living under God's grace can receive love and can give it back out. And that's the main thing that I want to show you, and I hope that together we'll turn away from the sin of cynicism and turn to the big-hearted life of love under God's grace. The cynical crowd is living under human strength by human power, but if we live under God's grace, we'll be open to being loved. We're going to see the root of cynicism, the results of cynicism, the rescue from cynicism, and then the big-hearted life. So first, the root of cynicism, if you're trying to write that down. The root, the results, the rescue, and the big-hearted life. Number one, the root of cynicism. Why are we cynical? Where does that come from? What's the heart behind it? And I'll say it this way. The root of cynicism is a self-protecting, fearful suspicion of false motives. The root of cynicism is a self-protecting, fearful suspicion of false motives. If you want one word, the root of cynicism is fear. Look with me, starting at verse 1. This chapter starts with two words. It says, after this. Well, after what? If you were here last week, you saw the story, David and Mephibosheth. Here's a quick recap. Once David had settled into Jerusalem as king over Israel, one of his first things that he wanted to do as king was show love to the house of his enemy. And so he asked his servants the question back in chapter 9, verse 1. He says, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for the sake of Jonathan? And that word kindness there is a really important word in the Hebrew Bible. It's a word that means steadfast love. It's the word for the steadfast love of God. It's the word for loving kindness or covenant faithfulness. It's a really big word that's hard to get into one English word. And so one of David's first acts as king is he wants to show this kind of kindness to someone from the house of his enemy, King Saul. Okay, now Saul, King Saul is dead, and David is now on the throne. And in chapter 9, verse 3, he asks the question again. He says, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? I want to show the steadfast love of God to one of my enemies from within Israel. That's what he wanted to do, and David did that, and Mephibosheth is that guy, Saul's grandson, and Mephibosheth was hiding out in Lodabar. He was in no place, and he was a cripple, but he was brought in, and he was given land, and he was given a seat at the king's table, and he ate there at the king's table as a son for the rest of his life. David showed the steadfast love of God, kindness, to Mephibosheth, one of his enemies, former enemies, in Israel. Now, after this is the beginning of chapter 10, after this, verse 1, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun his son reigned in his place. Now, the Ammonites had been enemies of King Saul, and, you know, you've heard that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We don't have the details, but apparently the Ammonites had done David some kind of favor, had shown loyalty to him, protected him maybe when King Saul was trying to kill David for over a decade. And so in verse 2, David says, this is what he says to his court. This is what's coming out of his heart. He says, I will deal loyally. Now, the word loyally is the same word as kindness. It's covenant faithfulness. I'm going to deal with steadfast love, okay? I'll deal with steadfast love with Hannah, or not Hannah, that is totally a typo, Hanan, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. So his father, the prior king who just passed away, showed steadfast love, faithfulness to David, and so David wants to continue that relationship with the Ammonites, and so he's going to show that to Hanan. Now, so we're talking about steadfast love, we're talking about covenant faithfulness, we're talking about a loving affection, okay, a feeling that is backed up by a legal allegiance. It is an emotion with a piece of paper. It's more than a feeling, but it's more than a piece of paper. It's both together. And David, in chapter 9, was looking for a former enemy within Israel to show that kind of love to. Here in chapter 10, he's looking for a former enemy outside of Israel to show that kind of love to. Okay, so it's kind of a study in contrast, right? Mephibosheth believes David, comes to him and receives his steadfast love. That is not what happens here with Hanan. And what David is doing in his kind of some of his first acts as king is he's showing to us God's own love. He's responding out of the love of God that he's received, and God's love is so outgoing, and now David wants to be outgoing. He's looking for people to show love to. So that's where David's heart is. And so David sends servants to the funeral of Nahash, the king who's just died. Now David's heart and his actions are aligned. He feels one way, and he's doing something about it. He has love and action to go with it, so he's loving Hanan, and he's doing what he said. But in verse 3, the cynical crowd enters the scene. The cynical crowd shows up. Listen to the voice of the cynical crowd again, verse 3. The princes of the Ammonites said to Hanan their lord, do you think because David has sent his comforters to you, that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city and to spy it out and to overthrow it? David comes with an act of love. These princes give voice. They're the voice of the cynical crowd. Do you think this person is really here because they care about you? Don't you know they're trying to use you and find your vulnerability so they can hurt you? You ever live like that? The root of cynicism is a self-protecting, fearful suspicion of false motives. Do you hear that voice in the world? Do you see that root in your own life? Hanan's princes, their first concern was to protect themselves by strength and power. They figured, Nahash is dead, David's going to turn on us. Let's get these guys out of here. Their concern to protect themselves by human strength and power made them fearfully suspicious of motives that they ascribe to David that are actually wrong. So their godless worldview, their living under human strength and power, led them to a very bad place. It led them to a place where they were unable to see the possibility that David really just loved them. Matthew Henry wrote a commentary on the whole Bible, and he brings out the depth of this problem when he writes it this way. He says, false men are ready to think others as false as themselves, and those that bear ill will to their neighbors are resolved not to believe that their neighbors bear any good will to them. Unfounded suspicion suggests a wicked mind. Now, what Matthew Henry is saying is that cynicism is not just something that's unhealthy and bad for relationships. He's saying deeper than that, that cynicism exposes a sinfulness and a rebelliousness and a godlessness in the heart, a living under human glory, human power. And so just in these first three verses, you can see that the root of cynicism is a self-protecting, fearful suspicion of false motives. Now, the rest of the chapter, number two, is about the results of cynicism. We've looked at the root. It's fear and self-protection. Now, the results. And I see five results of cynicism here. And the order that they come to us in the text are escalation, and then enemies, and then what I'm going to call mercenary relationships, and then judgment in defeat, and then a spreading fear. Okay, so number two, the results of cynicism, escalation, enemies, mercenary relationships, judgment in defeat, and a spreading fear. First, there's escalation. Now, if you've ever been in an argument, has anyone ever been in an argument? Yeah. You know what escalation is. You know, the tone starts here. Hey, it really bothered me when you did this. Oh, yeah, well, you did that. Yeah, but you did this. And the voices just get louder and louder. I don't have to play it out for you. Escalation, harsher and harsher. Now, according to verse 4, Hanun listened to the cynical voice of his princes, and he did this. He took David's servants, and he shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips, and he sent them away. Now, in those days, your beard was your manhood. Like, nobody shaved. You had a beard. And if you went around with half a beard, you were emasculated. But they don't stop there. They cut off the garment. So the garment is like a long thing, right? And they cut off the garment at the hip. Okay? Some of you had dreams about going to school dressed like this. The beard is a symbol of manhood, and then they're getting shamed by the exposing of their private manhood, okay? It is an act of deep shaming. And the Hebrew actually makes it even more explicit. That's what's going on. So, but that's what happened. They're deeply shamed. And David hears about it, and he's compassionate towards them. And he says, look, don't come home yet. You can stay in Jericho. Wait till your beards grow back, you know, get dressed, and then come home. Because you went and you were doing what I wanted you to do, and you don't return home in shame. David cares about his men. He's attentive to their honor. He cares. Now, meanwhile, you can see it's starting to escalate. By the time we get to verse 6, the Ammonites realize that this action that they've just done will mean war. What started as a gesture of love, right? Well, I was just brought this dinner home for you, or I just wanted to do this thing for you, or I just wanted to show love to your father, has now started in a huge argument that's going to end in war. So escalation is the first result of cynicism here in 2 Samuel 10, and maybe you've seen it happen, maybe you've done it, but I don't think you can argue that this does not happen. So escalation, and then that turns into the second result of cynicism, and that is enemies. The Ammonites now know that they're David's enemies. Now remember, this is important. Remember, they were afraid that they were David's enemies at the beginning, but they weren't. But then they escalated the situation, and now they are David's enemies. It says in verse 6, they had become a stench to David. You know, the very mention of them made David's nose wrinkle like a festering trash can in your kitchen, right? Dish disposal, it hasn't been running too long. So cynicism leads to foolish escalation that leads to real enemies. The fearful suspicion of motives often leads to the motives we fear. It's self-defeating, right? And then restraint, the restraint of escalation just ratchets tighter and tighter, and the pressure gets higher and higher, and then we've got enemies. I hope you haven't been there in your marriage, if you are married. But if you have, or if you're there now, there's hope for you. First, it's escalation. Then it's enemies. The third result of cynicism that comes out in this chapter is what I'm calling mercenary relationships. Now, literally, a mercenary is somebody that you hire to do your fighting for you, right? It's somebody that you pay to defend your cause. You kind of pay them to be your friend, to give their lives for the cause you care about. It's mercenary. It's not a love relationship. It's not a covenant relationship. It is just a contract. It's business. It's transactional. I give you this, you give me that. And that happened literally in this interaction between David and the Ammonites, because in verse 6, the Ammonites realize that they have made themselves an enemy, and so they send and hire 33,000 Syrian soldiers. And they know that they can't take David on their own, so they hire these people, and they're well beyond negotiation at this point. They're hiring guns, or chariots in this case. They are blowing right through the counseling. They're hiring a divorce lawyer. They're hiring somebody to do this. They're skipping over any humble vulnerability that might de-escalate the situation.
They're going straight to finding people who will pretend to be their friends so that they can feel like they're in the right and protect themselves when the time comes. I hope you already kind of start to see how that plays out in our lives. The cynical person can't have real friends because they're not open to being loved. The cynical person can only know transactional mercenary relationships because they can't believe that anybody would love them without any strings attached, without wanting something in return. So escalation, enemies, and mercenary relationships are three of the five results of cynicism in this chapter. And then the fourth result of cynicism in the chapter is judgment in defeat. Judgment in defeat. Now, Kelly, I didn't have Kelly read this part for us, but verse 9 through the end of the chapter is where we see this judgment in defeat. So there are, it describes basically two battles. And in these two battles, the Ammonites and the Syrians are wrecked. They're just wiped out. And this defeat is simultaneously two things at the same time. This defeat is, on the one hand, it's the fruit of a cynical heart. The fruit of a cynical heart ends in defeat. But on the same time, on the other hand, it's the judgment of God. It's the judgment of God. David heard about the Syrian mercenaries. He sent out his commander Joab and the mighty men to fight them and the Ammonites. If you're tracking along with me, I'm just going to summarize a little bit. The Ammonites gathered together on one side of the Israelites while the Syrian mercenaries gathered on the other side. Now Joab, David's commander, saw that his forces were caught between two groups of enemies, and he split his men in half. He said he led half of the men against the Syrians, and he appointed his brother Abishai to go against the other half of the Ammonites. And they agreed that if either of them was struggling, that they would help the other one out. And then Joab says this in verse 12. Joab makes a statement of faith because he knows that God directs the flow of all history. And in verse 12, he says to his brother, "Be of good courage. Let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him." And the Lord Yahweh did what seemed good to him. And the Ammonites and the Syrians were both routed. They were both defeated. They ran away. And then the Syrians gathered themselves together again to come against Israel. And that time, David himself came out, heading up the armies of Israel. And here's what happens, as it says in verse 18, "The Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Shobak, the commander of their army, so that he died there. The will of the Lord was done on the battlefield. Judgment fell, and they died." Now, I'm not going to say that cynicism always immediately leads to kind of judgment and defeat that we see here. But I will say that in the long run, cynicism is a self-defeating, self-protection strategy. On the day of judgment, Jesus will not be impressed with our self-protection. He'll be impressed by those who live under God's grace by leaving their very lives in the hands of God. And I said, I see five results of cynicism: escalation, enemies, mercenary relationships, judgment, and defeat. And the fifth result of cynicism is a spreading fear. A spreading fear. Verse 19. "When all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore." So fear is both the root of a cynical heart and the fruit of a cynical heart. Fear is where it starts, and then that fear spreads to other people. And note that the Syrians' fear is an isolating fear. The Ammonites were afraid that they were alone, and that's what got them into this mess. And now the Syrians are afraid to help anybody ever again, especially the Ammonites. They're afraid. So fear spreads. The Ammonites were afraid to trust David, but that fear spread. So escalation, enemies, mercenary relationships, judgment and defeat, and a spreading fear. The costs of cynicism are high, very high. A self-protective and suspicious outlook promises safety that it doesn't deliver. It promises life, but it is a shriveled and dying kind of life. And I've been there, and some of you have been there. You know. I've watched how the cynical take destroys relationships. Oh, he's not really saying that for my interest. Oh, she's not really here because she loves me. Oh, they're not really about what they say they're about. So I'm warning you against the cynical take. I'm holding up the mirror of this chapter to warn you against the suspicious, self-protective, human-centered fear that is at the root of cynicism. The results of cynicism are bad. They're wicked. So sever the root. Take an axe to the self-protective fear that leads to cynicism. So far in this chapter, we've seen the root and the results. Now, number three, we need to remember the rescue from cynicism. What is the rescue from cynicism? What's the axe that we can take to the root of self-protective fear in our lives? Well, the axe, or the rescue from cynicism, is the covenant love of God for you and for me in the cross of Jesus Christ. That is the rescue from cynicism. The covenant love of God in the cross of Jesus Christ. The gospel is the rescue from cynicism. What is it that we fear that leads us to cynicism? Larry Crabb, in a great little book called Encouragement, The Unexpected Power of Building Others Up, he's a Christian. He looks back to Genesis 3 to answer the question, what is it that we fear that leads us to cynicism? And he says that in Genesis 3, we see the first sin enter the world, and we see the results of it. Adam and Eve eat of the one tree that God commanded them not to eat of, and then God comes and finds them in the garden, and he asks what happened, and Adam says in Genesis 3:10, do you remember Genesis 3:10? I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. I mean, that's it. Adam was afraid, fear. Why? Because he was naked. He realized he was exposed. Larry Crabb says that because of Adam's sin, the fear of exposure and the fear of rejection start with all of us in childhood, and then they infect all of our lives. The fear of exposure, and then the fear that we'll be seen and known and not loved. Fear of rejection. Well, over and over, the Lord commands his people, do not fear, do not fear. Don't be anxious for anything. But how is it possible not to fear when we know that we have something to hide and that rejection is possible and all too common? How can I not be afraid when I know that you may see me for what I really am and reject me? How's that possible? Possible because of the cross of Jesus Christ. The cross of Christ makes it so that, Romans 8:1, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. No condemnation before God himself. And God himself is all-seeing. He knows everything you've ever done, thought, or said. He knows the sin of my heart deeper than I know it myself, deeper than you can see it in me. He knows the wickedness of my own heart. And he so loved the world, including me and you, if you're in Christ, that he gave his son. He saw me. He knew me. He loved me. And the historical concrete evidence is the cross of Christ, where he died to pay the penalty for our sin, to take it away from us. Our shame was nailed to the cross when God himself was humbled and made vulnerable and naked and suffered. And Christ has been raised to new life so that now we are wrapped up in Jesus' perfection, if you believe in Jesus. So God sees you, he knows your sin, but as far as the east is from the west, he's removed it from you because he's put it on Christ and taken it away outside the camp. And now when he looks at you, if you believe in Jesus, he sees Jesus. Romans 8:15 says, you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons by whom we cry, Abba, Father. He welcomes you to the table. He brings you into his family. How can you and I live without the sinful, self-protective fear that leads to cynicism?
can do it only by believing that the cross is true, that God does love us, he knows us perfectly, and he loves us. See, some, we try to engage in relationships and try to pretend that it doesn't hurt when people hurt us, but it does. Or some of us will withdraw from a relationship to try to protect ourselves so we don't have to feel that fear. And I've been so guilty of that. Let me just put up a little bit of a wall here, and then I don't have to be afraid. The only thing that will let us engage in relationships where people can really see us is believing in the cross of Christ, that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Nothing can break his love for us. So that's the only true rescue from the cynical life, the covenant love of God for you and for me. Do you have it? Do you know it? Do you tell it to yourself all the time? Do you depend on it? How can we be free from the fear of being wounded by knowing? We can do it by knowing that whatever people may do to us, we have a risen Savior and Lord who loves us. So open your heart to that love. We've seen the root, the results, and the rescue, and I want to leave us with a clear picture of the opposite of cynicism, and I'm calling it the big-hearted life. The big-hearted life. Let me just say first quickly two things that the big-hearted life is not, okay? The big-hearted life is not gullible. It doesn't believe everything everybody says. That's not what I'm saying is big-hearted. We have to be wise. We have to use discernment. Jesus himself would not entrust himself to people because he knew what was in them. There's a certain level of boundary. The Bible does not encourage gullibility. And the second thing I want to be careful to say, because whenever I talk about this kind of thing, there's like a danger in here. And I want to say this, that the big-hearted life is not continuing on in being in an abusive relationship, okay? I hate to bring that up, but that's the reality some people live in. And do not mishear me if that's you. I'm not saying that to be big-hearted, you need to like just put rose-colored glasses over the person who may be beating you or abusing you in some way. That's not big-hearted. What's big-hearted in that case would be for them to experience justice and for you to get out safely and talk to an elder or a leader or law enforcement if you're ready for that, okay? So just quickly, kind of caveats. Two things the big-hearted life is not. It's not gullible. It's not stupid. And it's not staying in an abusive relationship. But here's what it is. The big-hearted life, what does it look like? The mirror image, the flip side of this chapter is in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7. Now, in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4 through 7, they describe what love is, a famous love chapter. But what I want to draw your attention to is this. This is the flip side of this chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, 7. Love believes all things. That's what the big-hearted life is in this. Love believes all things. In other words, the big-hearted life assumes the very best motives of the other person until proven otherwise. Assumes the very best motives of the other person until proven otherwise. Love, the big-hearted life, doesn't just jump to the cynical take. And it can do that because of the safety that there is in the adoption of Christ. And as a result of this kind of love, this assuming the best, relationships can be restored and not ravaged. Arguments can be de-escalated and not escalated. Peace can be sown and not war. Love is spread as a result and not fear. See, Hanan cynically protected himself from love and he isolated himself with an armed, self-protected fear. But Mephibosheth faithfully accepted the king's summons and was lavished with love and a seat at the king's own table. The big-hearted life is open to receiving love, and receiving love can only happen through the death of cynicism, and cynicism can only die by faith in Christ. And then comes the hard work of dying to a man-centered fear and living in God-centered love. And that's the journey that we get to be on as a church from now until Jesus comes again, putting to death man-centered fear and living in God-centered love. Now, this is where it's very personal. This is where it gets intimate, okay? This is part of why we have a church covenant, so that anybody who is a member here, they've signed a piece of paper that says, I'm committed to you and you're committed to me, because we hope that that helps kind of put some boundaries on the place and some safety into place to where I can truly be vulnerable with you and you can truly be vulnerable with me. Most people don't live under a covenant like that, but we try to for that reason. But we know it's not easy because we still are afraid in the church, aren't we? How will this person respond if I'm honest? If I tell them something true about me that I wish wasn't true about me? Or how will they respond if I have to correct them about sin? How will they react if I warn them? It is easy to be ruled by fear and not have that conversation. And here's where it gets crazy, because that's called conflict avoidance. And at the end of the day, conflict avoidance is the same, has the same root as conflict escalation, fear. And any church that isn't willing to love by confronting is not really open to being loved and growing in the love of Christ. Conflict avoidance is just conflict escalation deferred. Okay? So, if you're with me and a conflict avoider, y'all, it's coming. Go have the conversation. It's worse if you wait. Okay? Promise.
Promise.
Go have it. Let God's love open your heart to his own love and to being loved and the giving love. Because the cynical crowd is living under human strength. They're living in sin. And it infects the church. But those living under God's grace can receive love and can give love back out. Let me give you just one example. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be disagreement. There's going to be sin in the church. And you're going to be tempted to say to yourself, that person doesn't love me. This church doesn't love me. You might be tempted to say to them, you don't love me. This church doesn't love me. And that is cynically assigning a bad motive. Don't do that. Don't do that until it's proven. Instead, go to the person and say to them, hey, what you said, that thing you said, made me feel this way, made me hurt, scared, felt alone, felt like you didn't care. Don't say, you don't care about me. Say, I felt like you didn't care about me. Okay? And then say, next time, would you say it this way? That's one example. And then when that person comes to you, don't respond by saying, how dare you correct me? Like, you're going to feel the hair start to rise in the back of your neck, maybe. Don't do that. Say, hey, you felt hurt because I said that? I'm hearing you say that you felt hurt. I'm sorry. If you can say this honestly, it wasn't my intention to hurt you. Don't tell them why you said it that way. Don't start in, you know, I was having a bad day and, you know, my dog died and my hamster ran away. That just sounds like you're defending yourself. That's not the time. Just tell them, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. That's an example. There's a danger in loving each other like this. There's a danger in being vulnerable with each other like this and saying, hey, you hurt me, or hey, that hurt me, and being willing to receive that and hear that. And the danger is that we'll love each other, and that's a risky place to be. And C.S. Lewis just puts it this way, and I want to read this to you. He says, love anything, and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give it to nobody, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your own selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. Just to be vulnerable. So God himself became vulnerable. He had a big heart. He opened his arms wide. Open your heart to being vulnerable. It'll change your heart. It'll change your home. It'll change the church. It'll change the world. Let's go to him in vulnerability now. Let's pray.